This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear what happened to a controversial program set up by DC police last summer. They set up checkpoints around the city's Trinidad neighborhood and denied access to drivers who refused to disclose personal information.
You won't believe this story until you hear it. You can't drive on a public street anymore, but luckily, lawyers in the community stopped that program.
We talk with Rabbi Brian Walt, who's organizing a Jewish fast for Gaza.
As of now, 60 rabbis on the third Thursday of every month don't eat from sunrise to sunset. Hundreds of others have joined them in their efforts to bring attention to the plight of the Palestinians, break the blockade, and open negotiations with Hamas.
Stay with us.
Michael, a number of task force that Obama had set up are now beginning to report on what should be done about Guantanamo and so-called terrorists there. Bring us up to date.
Yeah, I just want to point out it's not just terrorists, so-called terrorists, alleged terrorists at Guantanamo, but it's really to formulate policies for what should happen to alleged terrorists captured anywhere in the world. And that's an important point as we get into the discussion. When Obama took office a couple of days after he took office, he signed a number of executive orders that set up task forces. One was to try and close Guantanamo, and that was supposed to give a full report at 6 months. That 6 months expired last week, and the task force said they couldn't complete their report in time, that they're only halfway through looking at the detainees. That is, we know that only 11 have been released in the last 6 months. Bush had a better record. And so that task force is lagging. And I'm not, at this point, sanguine that Guantanamo will be closed in the year that Obama said it would be. And, of course, even if it's closed, there's all kinds of other problems about recreating it another place. But I'm not even clear they can clear out Guantanamo in 6 months. And the task force has been really dragging its feet, in my view. Our attorneys, you know, talk to these people on occasion. They try and get our clients to be moved out of Guantanamo. But it's really a slow process. So one problem already is that the process of closing Guantanamo is slowed. I'll be very surprised in 6 months if the last person is out of Guantanamo. That's one. The one that actually came out again with only an interim report is a second task force called the Detention Policy Task Force. And in a memorandum for the Attorney General for Holder, they gave what's called a preliminary report. There's only one way to say it. It's disgusting. Really, there's nothing else to say about what these guys are doing, because they're supposed to formulate a detention policy, not just for people at Guantanamo, but for other alleged terrorists or alleged suspects picked up around the world. And they come up with what Obama really began to reflect in his May 21st speech, which is three categories of way of treating people. One is to try them in criminal courts, which is, of course, what the Center for Constitutional Rights and anybody who gives a hang about civil liberties ought to care about. That's option one. Option two is that they should be tried by military commissions, which, of course, Obama condemned and voted against when he was in the Senate, along with a number of other people. And option three is preventive detention. So two out of the three options that the preliminary report are suggesting be made into law, whether through executive order or Congress, are really outside the pale of human rights. It's a very, very sad day. And some of the best writing on that, actually, has come out of Glenn Greenwald in Salon, and I recommend the articles, because what Glenn Greenwald points out is the whole argument that there's some people at Guantanamo that we cannot try because the evidence is some torture from the Bush administration, and we don't want to release them because they're too dangerous, whatever that means, but too dangerous, according to various people, to let out. We have no choices but to either convict them in a military commission, which means you can use evidence from torture or some kind of evidence, and if you can't, to hold them somehow in preventive detention. What Greenwald points out, when you read the report of the task force carefully, not even carefully, it stands out, is the task force and Obama, President Obama, are not just making policy for Guantanamo and for people who, quote, supposedly can't be tried, but for future detention policy when suspects are picked up all over the world. So what they're really saying now is this is not about Bush. This is about the United States in the future using military commissions and preventive detention in ways that it should never, never have been used, but in which we at least some hopes that they wouldn't use it. So it's really bad. Greenwald's article just rips it to pieces, saying it's inexcusable what's going on now. So that's a bad report on both military commissions and preventive detention.
Well, it reminds me of that famous saying by Clemenceau, the old French politician, who said, military justice is to justice as military music is to music. Once they undermine what has been over 200 years of tradition of having civilian trials and the due process that is attached to that, and once they've done that internationally, there's nothing to stop it from coming here. And given the various crises that are on the horizon in this country, the real scary thing is that it's going to get legs abroad. It threatens our liberties here as well.
This is a line that should never be crossed. That's the line, right, of military commissions and the line of preventive detention should never be crossed, and the evil will live after Obama. One thing Glenn Greenwald says about it, he said, it's interesting. I laid out these three options: federal court trials, military commissions, and preventive detention as ways of treating people. And what he basically says, who's going to decide who goes into what? And he says the basic rule about who's going to be tried by which one is the government, the Obama administration, will try the suspect in whatever process that, quote, ensures that the state will always win.
That's right.
So if they don't think they can convict him in criminal court, they'll bring him before the military commission. If they don't think they can convict him in the military commission, then they'll put him in preventive detention. So the bottom line of this system of trial, as Glenn Greenwald says, ensures that the state will always win. Greenwald quotes, and as I quoted in my earliest, what's interesting, my earliest article on military commissions in 2001, I did the quote from Alice in Wonderland, and people probably remember it about the sentence and the verdict. And I quoted Alice in Wonderland, and Greenwald does the same thing. And here's the way it goes. It's about the Queen's justice. It's chapter 12 of Alice in Wonderland. Quote, "Let the jury consider their verdict," the king said for about the 20th time that day. "No, no," said the queen. "Sentence first, verdict afterward." "Stuff and nonsense," said Alice loudly. "The idea of having the sentence first?" "Hold your tongue," said the queen, turning purple. "I won't," said Alice. "Off with her head," the queen shouted at the top of her voice. So what we have now is a system of sentence first, verdict afterwards.
That's exactly
it's
right.
It's Alice in Wonderland.
Exactly. Michael, there's been a lot of speculation that Attorney General Eric Holder may appoint a special prosecutor to look into the torture crimes, that there's pressure on him, and that he's mulling over what to do. What's your take on that?
You know, first of all, I'm amazed when I read the New York Times. They've had two articles on this, and they claim that Holder is under pressure not to do this, that Obama doesn't want this done. This is a joke. I mean, I read that, I am ready to scream. How could a New York Times writer with any kind of credibility write that Obama will oppose what Holder does, or that Holder will do something on this that Obama doesn't want?
He serves at the will of the president. They try to make a distinction between his duties as the attorney general to uphold the law and his duties politically to Obama.
I can't read this stuff. It says when Holder read the CIA report on the interrogations that had no deletions, he said he was so shocked that he decided maybe I have to do something. Well, come on, this is ridiculous. I mean, obviously Obama, he's not going to do anything that's going to jeopardize Obama's ability to get legislation through or whatever else. So that's the first thing. So it's all BS you're reading in the Times. The second thing about it is, let's look at what Holder's doing. He's doing what I really talked about, I think, last week when I said he's not prosecuting anybody who goes up to the line of what you and Bybee and Rumsfeld and Tenet allowed. So if you waterboarded al-Qaeda people, supposedly al-Qaeda people, or you waterboarded Abu Zubaydah, or you waterboarded somebody else, and you did it as you were instructed to do by you or Tenet or others, you're not going to be prosecuted. You're immunized. It's only if you went beyond what you were instructed to do, which means to say that no higher officials will ever be prosecuted. It's some lower level guy, possibly, who went beyond the written instructions. And here's what again, Glenn Greenwald says about that. Holder's plan, at least for the moment, is to confine the prosecutor's authority to investigate CIA agents who went beyond what you and Bush decreed could be done. Quote from Greenwald, "He used more water than you said he could." Quote, "He tied him up longer than you authorized." Quote, The room was colder and the freezing water icier than you allowed. Or as I said, he ripped off one testicle and not two. He broke one bone in his body and not two. So what we're talking about is a very thin little look at some CIA agents who may have gone beyond authorized torture. And what that does is a number of things. One is, of course, exempts all the higher-ups. It immunizes them. And, of course, as is pointed out in many by a number of people, it makes the CIA guys really mad because the CIA guys, yeah, they may have gone beyond the lower-level guys, but it's the upper guys who authorized this broad program of torture. So it's total junk, the whole thing. So the idea that Obama somehow opposes this is probably not true. Going after a couple of guys who waterboarded someone 180 times instead of 80, I don't think is a huge issue for Obama. I think that's probably what they're going to be able to do. And the subsequent positive for them is they may be able to then send notes to Spain and other countries saying, oh, we're looking at our torture program, and therefore you guys shouldn't look at it.
Exactly.
So this is another made-up New York Times story. It's hard for me to bear it. It was in there again last week, and it's hard for me to read the stuff.
Last summer, Washington, D.C. police set up checkpoints around the city's Trinidad neighborhood and denied access to drivers who refused to disclose their destination. The purpose of the checkpoints, according to the Metropolitan Police Department, was to deter violence after a string of drive-by shootings in 2008. Recently, a federal appeals court ruled that these checkpoints are unconstitutional. In the opinion of Chief Judge David Sentell of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, quote, citizens have a right to drive upon the public streets of the District of Columbia or any other city, absent a constitutionally sound reason for limiting their access. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard is an attorney and co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice, which represented three drivers challenging the checkpoints. She joins us now to discuss this case. Welcome, Mara, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
It seems that every time we have you on as a guest, we're here to celebrate a huge constitutional victory. And today is no different.
Oh, that's a nice way to look at it.
Should only be so easy, right, Mara?
That's right.
We only have you on when you win.
Just so our listeners know, you had challenged practice of D.C. police of setting up checkpoints in certain neighborhoods, Trinidad being one, ostensibly because it would cut down on crime.
There were car checkpoints, right?
Yes, in the District of Columbia last summer, the mayor and the attorney general here deployed this extraordinary checkpoint program in which it was really a blockade or barricade program. The special order for the police department authorized sealing off of an entire neighborhood, the police sealing the entrances, setting up checkpoints, allowing no one in without them being seized by car, no one to drive in on public roadways, without being seized by the police and interrogated. It's a seizure and interrogation program. The police would question you as to what you were doing, where you were going, who you were visiting, demanded that you provide them identity information, information on your associates, information on your plan, information on what you were doing, who you knew, phone numbers for the people you want to visit, and information like that. And then...
Wait a second. Before you got there, if I drove my car into this neighborhood, that would have happened to me?
Yes.
Everybody who went in?
Yes. Yes.
No suspicion, nothing? I didn't drop any drugs outside the window or anything like that?
And the police acknowledged that there was no suspicion, no allegation that any driver had engaged in criminal activity or was going to engage in criminal activity. And then they would not allow you to drive farther on a public roadway unless you met what the police considered a legitimate reason. You had to prove to the satisfaction of the police that you had what they called a legitimate reason to travel further.
Wow, that is, I just can't believe they even thought they could get away with it.
And, you know, that's what we thought, but yet they went to court, and when we challenged them in court, they stayed in court. They didn't take this program down. They were hauled before the D.C. Council and defended the program, saying they thought it was absolutely constitutional. The chief of police went before a bank of cameras and said, I'm going to continue to deploy this program until a judge orders me to stop.
Mara, it wasn't that easy, because when you first brought this to court, you lost.
That's right. When we brought this before the District Court for the District of Columbia and sought a preliminary injunction, that court declined to issue the preliminary injunction, which is why we took it up on appeal to the D.C. Circuit.
Tell me about the plaintiffs you had in the case. What happened to them? What What were they doing?
Well, the plaintiffs in the case included William Robinson, who was a 50-year resident of Trinidad. He had lived there really since it was desegregated. He was a retired D.C. school teacher and knew that neighborhood, knew the kids in the neighborhood, knew everyone in the neighborhood, and was on the block where the first checkpoint was set up. And the way he described it was he went outside and he felt like he was living under martial law, and he wanted it to end. And he had tried to come into the neighborhood, and by their terms, he would have been allowed to drive in as a resident of the neighborhood, but he would still have to be stopped at the checkpoint to get into his own home and have to answer questions from the police and have to prove his identity and prove where he lived, which he didn't want to do. But it also meant that his former students who would come visit him, because he was also a coach in D.C. And well-loved, would have to go through this, and they stopped visiting because, you know, it's not unusual that a lot of people don't want to have to get tangled with the police, people who've done nothing wrong. We all know that the police do enormous racial profiling and police misconduct and abuse of people who are completely innocent. So having these checkpoints was having a really tremendous effect on his life. So he was one of the plaintiffs, and unfortunately, and this was very sad, he passed away during the pendency of the appeal. And so he never learned the outcome of this. But we thought he was very courageous and very principled man to stand up and fight for this. And the other plaintiffs in the case were community organizers and other people who were just traveling in their cars and were stopped at the checkpoints. And among them, some of them were willing to give their identities and say, well, here's my driver's license, and yeah, I can prove that who I am, but I'm not going to tell you who I'm meeting with. I'm not going to tell you where I'm going. I'm not going to give you the phone number of my friends. One of the plaintiffs who was stopped was a community organizer who didn't want to tell them what her political activities were and what the community meeting was that she was going to.
Was she allowed through?
No.
You also mentioned earlier that police might not let people through if they deemed their purpose not legitimate, even if the people complied with showing ID.
That's correct. It's not merely that you get stopped by the police and you can explain your way in, which no one should have to go through. The police set up what they called legitimate reasons for entry, and there were six defined categories. And you had to fall into one of those six categories, or no matter what, you were not going to be allowed in. You could be a resident. If you were employed or on a commercial delivery in this area, they call these areas that they seal off a neighborhood safety zone. Whenever they do these kind of programs, gang injunctions or checkpoint programs, they always seem to have the word safety in them everywhere in the country. But one of the other areas was attending school or taking a child to school, or that you had a family member who lived there, or that you were attempting to attend what they called a verified organized civic community or religious event, which means you'd have to prove to the police that it was a, I don't even know what that means, but verified event, one that they accepted as being a legitimate political or religious event that you could attend. And the other category was not actually conduct or intention, its status was that if you were elderly or disabled, which, again, you know, makes very little sense in any type of constitutional framework for what they were trying to do. But, for example, if you were visiting a friend, that is not a legitimate reason. You may not enter. If you're going to a grocery store to pick up groceries, that is not a legitimate reason. You may not enter. And there's any number of lawful reasons that people travel down a public roadway, you know, to get from one place to another that would not be legitimate reasons.
What did the courts say when they finally struck down this ordinance?
Well, the court's language was unambiguous. It was a unanimous three-judge panel. Two of the judges, in fact, were appointed by President Reagan. And they said that the plaintiffs had demonstrated irreparable injury, that a preliminary injunction, we had met all the standards for a preliminary injunction, that it should have issued. They wrote that it's apparent that appellants' constitutional rights are violated by the program. And made it very clear. They even cited in the ruling more than once the chief of police statement about continuing the program until a judge orders me to stop. And with that ruling, they then remanded, fully reversed the lower court and remanded.
Now, let me ask a question about this case compared to other cases around the country, and sort of a two-part question. One is, are there other similar situations around the country like this? And secondly, we had a case in New York, of course, of searching bags on the subway arbitrarily, essentially, you know, at random. And we lost that case, and I can, as a lawyer, understand some of the differences, but I'd like to hear you talk about what effect this might have on the rest of the country, this victory, where else is this going on, and then some way of thinking about the New York City backpack search case.
This program itself is one that we're not aware of being deployed anywhere else in the country of this magnitude and scope. They certainly set up checkpoints all over the United States now, and more of them. And I think that there are questions about the constitutionality and legality of those checkpoint programs in many places. But this program, the seizure and the interrogation and the sealing of neighborhoods, the only other time that we're aware of something like this ever being done was in New York in the 90s. And it was never adjudicated on the full constitutional merits of the case. There was a ruling that dealt with qualified immunity. It dealt with whether or not a police officer was properly on notice as to the law in his execution of the checkpoints or his conduct, actually, to a plaintiff in a case. But that's the only situation we're aware of where this had ever happened. And that situation in New York predated a Supreme Court ruling in 2000 called Edmund versus City of Annapolis, in which the court said that you may not set up checkpoints for the general purpose of crime control. Because, of course, if crime becomes the predicate for suspension of basic fundamental Fourth Amendment rights, then there would be no fundamental Fourth Amendment rights to speak of. And the courts have said that there are certain types of checkpoints you can have. You can have sobriety checkpoints to stop drunk drivers, for example. You can have license and registration checkpoints.
Let me stop you on the sobriety one. Does that mean you could set up a checkpoint in which everybody who goes through has to take a sobriety test?
Yes.
I know we have similar ones in New York, not similar, but analogous, I guess, where they have a guy look in your car to make sure your seatbelt's on. A cop looks.
Right, and that's like the license and registration roadway safety concept, so they can make sure you're licensed, you're registered, you have your seatbelt.
So they could have done this in Washington. Instead of setting up a neighborhood, the one of stopping everybody going through just on with different reasons for driving on the road, they could have set up, I don't want you to answer that it's legal, but under what you're saying, they could have had a cop car stop every car and say, show me your license and registration. Is that right?
And they do that. They do it in D.C. and they do it, in New York, they do it all over the place. I think, as you and I both know, they do that all the time, even though they say it's a safety checkpoint. They pick a particular community, particular neighborhood. I mean, they're not doing it everywhere. They're just doing it in some places. And there have been challenges brought to the execution of those because, as a broad concept, they're allowed to have these safety checkpoints because they deal with roadway safety. The challenges to those come in the execution. Are they really stopping every car or every third car? You can't have discretion left to the cop.
Right. Otherwise, that allows race and all kinds of things.
Right. But they're allowed to have those. They're allowed to have border checkpoints, and checkpoints set up close to borders that deal with whether or not people are documented. The courts have allowed those.
Now, but in the subway case, I guess the one thing that I think the court said in the subway case that before your bag is inspected and you get on the subway, you have a right to walk away. And I guess what they're saying underlying it, it's not like a public road, a subway. A subway is something you have to pay to get on it.
I think that, and they also define those in this sort of special needs category, akin to if you're going into, a courthouse, there's a certain search related to that, or a federal building, or if you're getting on an airplane. So it's the combination of the ability to walk away, but it's also the special needs safety issue. And I agree with the position that you took in opposing the bag searches in the subways. They've implemented them here in D.C. too now. But that's where the courts have leaned on those types of searches. And in the district, what they tried to say is they tried to say that the seizure and interrogation checkpoints were legitimate because if you pulled up to them and you didn't want to answer questions, you could turn around and go some other way.
I got you. The same sort of argument.
Right, but we argued that that was inapplicable here because, in fact, the issue is you have the right to travel down a public roadway without being seized by the police without any allegation of criminal activity or suspicion of criminal wrongdoing.
And also the right to association, to go visit friends without having to explain what you're going to discuss, especially if it's a political meeting.
Yes, I mean, implemented First Amendment issues, certainly, with regard to the plaintiffs that were engaging in political organizing and political activity. You should not have to give the government the names of your associates, their phone numbers, or the nature of, the political discussion you're about to engage in.
I assume that Trinidad is not a rich white neighborhood.
It is a predominantly African-American community. However, it is also on the cusp or in the process of gentrification. We're seeing a lot of these programs in the district being rolled out in areas that are moving towards gentrification. I think that there are a lot of folks in D.C. who believe, and I think reasonably so, that there's often an initiative coming from the police and the government to make people feel like criminals in their own homes, in their own neighborhoods, making their own neighborhoods miserable places to live. At the same time, there are real problems of street crime and violence, but the community wants a genuine response to that, and they're entitled to get a response from the government that addresses community needs. But this program was not only unconstitutional, it was completely ineffective. Where the community was calling out and saying, you know, we need some help, we need some support here. There had been a triple homicide that had occurred, and instead what they did is just basically photo opportunities. I see these programs that they keep rolling out here as basically publicity stunts masquerading as a policy. You know, and they could address the real needs, but instead they come out and they set up checkpoints and put people under martial law.
They could have stationed several beat cops throughout the neighborhood. And a second problem is that, as you said, they're gathering information, written information with identifications of individuals.
That was one of the claims that we raised in the lower court, which was very troubling and I think was another major reason for this program. They were collecting identity information on people, and we found out that they were putting it into basically criminal, quasi-criminal, or criminal database. And this is on lawful drivers, their associates, you know, what they were doing, the passengers. And as part of our initial complaint, we demanded that they cease that activity and that they expunge those databases, this information. And the government had to agree to that right away, because I think that they knew that there was no way they could move forward with that program. But they were sending in tag readers, which are, I think they're probably using them in New York now too, but in D.C., they're mounting these cameras on government vehicles, and they do this mass scan of license plate tags and basically suck up the information as to where you're driving and where people are at any given point in day and time. And they were doing that there, too.
I'm just so amazed. I mean, I guess police departments are on the country, but this is D.C., which is a city, of course, what, 80-85% African-American with an African-American mayor. I'm amazed.
Well, the mayor in the district is African-American and ran for office in a very populist agenda, which he has been, it's been widely acknowledged he has completely abandoned since he took office. The Attorney General of the District of Columbia is a wealthy white corporate lawyer who lived in Virginia until a couple months ago because he was forced to move into D.C. as a condition of holding his position.
I should have forced him to move to Trinidad.
And, you know, he's rented a temporary apartment, still maintains his mansion in Great Falls. And he's really been a driving force behind a lot of the programs and policies that we're seeing coming from the government and the district. You know, on the point of the effectiveness of the program, too, and I think it's important to point out, when we saw their own statistics that the police department submitted to the court to justify this case, and we went through their own numbers show that violent crime doubled during the period of time that the checkpoints were in operation. And there were internal police emails where the police were complaining that 911 calls were going unresponded to because the police were immobilized at these checkpoints.
Mara, once again, congratulations. I mean, you deserve a lot of congratulations, but it seems like it should have been much easier to put this program to rest. That you had to go to the Court of Appeals is quite shocking to me.
It's one of those situations, yeah, where it's when you win, then everyone looks around and says, yeah, that's so unconstitutional. But when you're litigating it in hard-fought litigation, it's that battle. But we do think, at the end of the day, if we had not succeeded with this in the district, I think we would have seen this as a model for implementation in urban environments throughout the United States.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, we're already, as I said, pushing up against it in these license checks, mm-hmm. in these sobriety checks, and these backpack checks on subways. And you know, you could see this being the next step on that. So I think it's great.
Is there a chance that the government's going to appeal this?
Well, they've said that they're evaluating whether or not they'd seek an en banc review, you know, a full court review, or take it to the Supreme Court. They've told the press that they're looking at both. I think that it would be incredibly unwise to do that, but if that's where they want to waste their resources, you know, then they can. It may be that they're just saying that for the sake of having something to say to the press in the wake of, you know, a resounding defeat for this illegal program.
That's what I would think. I mean, I didn't look at your panel, but what was your panel? It was Santel and who else?
With Chief Judge Santel, Ginsburg, and Rogers. So yeah. Both judges, Santel and Ginsburg, of course, are appointed by Ronald Reagan.
Well, Mara, thank you again for being there.
Thanks for sticking with it, Mara.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today we are pleased to speak with Rabbi Brian Walt. Rabbi Walt is the coordinator of the Jewish Fast for Gaza, a new initiative meant to break the blockade of Gaza. 70 American rabbis have launched a water-only fast aimed at breaking the Jewish community's silence over Israel's collective punishment of the Palestinians. The initiative is called the Jewish Fast for Gaza, and includes Reform, Reconstructionist, Orthodox, and Conservative rabbis who call for lifting the blockade on Gaza. It also now includes hundreds of others, Muslims, Christians, and other religious leaders. Today we are really pleased to talk with Rabbi Walt.
Rabbi Brian Walt, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you.
It's an honor for us to have you and to we know about the kind of work that your group is doing, but why don't you familiarize our audience with the name of your group and what you're doing generally and specifically about this fast you've organized in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza to break the siege.
Right. So, Michael, thank you for inviting me. It's an honor to be on your program and an honor to be with people who have done so much dedicated work to uphold justice for both peoples, but for the Palestinian people too. The genesis of the Jewish Fast for Gaza, Ta'anit Tzedek, the Hebrew word, was a conversation with a colleague of mine, a rabbinic colleague, Rabbi Brant Rosen. He's a very wonderful congregational rabbi of a large congregation out in Chicago. And as I've said to other people, I think he was probably the most courageous congregational rabbi during the Gaza war. There may be other congregational rabbis who did things, and I'm sure there are. I know there are. But he's among the most courageous.
I totally agree with you. When I read what he wrote on his blog, I wrote my cousin and said, I think your rabbi is going to lose his job.
Right. Well, the thing to be said for his congregation is that he hasn't lost his job, and his congregation has stood by him, and he has stood by them. He is very devoted to them. And I think it's very important that he be able to hold on, because so many rabbis don't speak out on these issues primarily out of fear and primarily out of fear for self-preservation. Some rabbis disagree, but many more rabbis would be joining our initiative. So I had a conversation with Brant Rosen, with Rabbi Rosen, and we both were just stunned by the silence of the rabbinate during the Gaza war in December. We, in fact, had some plans to try to issue a rabbinical statement during that time, and it fell apart. Months later, as the suffering in Gaza intensifies, we have made another effort, which actually has gone public, which is Jewish Fast for Gaza, and the idea is we found, initially, as you said, you know, he would lose his job. We set our goal as finding 10 rabbis. In Judaism, 10's a minyan. A minyan is a community for a sacred purpose. In tradition, for the purpose of communal prayer. But we understood it as a community that would be in solidarity, a community of vision, a community of principle that would break the silence in our community about the suffering in Gaza.
I was just so pleased, really, to see this effort. I just think it's extraordinary. And continue. I know there's a number of goals you have. I'd be interested in the support that you're getting, whether you're getting any antipathy in the Jewish community, et cetera.
Right. So we found this minyan, this community, and we went public with this idea of a fast for Gaza, a Jewishly initiated monthly fast for Gaza, not a Jewish-only initiative, a Jewish-initiated event that would draw people of all faiths. So one of the things that's interesting about and unique about the Jewish fast for Gaza, it's Jewishly initiated, and I'll explain why in a moment, but it's also draws and invites people of conscience, people of different faiths, and we especially welcome Christians and Muslims and people of conscience. It has four goals. We were devastated by the suffering caused by the war, and then the siege just exacerbates that suffering. Here you have people who've lost their homes, their shops, their means of livelihood, and now they face a siege which prevents them from doing anything to rebuild after this attack. And moreover, we have here a situation where Israel, which claims to be the state of the Jewish people and is seen as such by Jews around the world, is preventing food from reaching a whole population. And in fact, the outrage here is, and that people just don't pay attention to, which is the fact that the state that is the state of the Jewish people is preventing food from reaching children whose growth is stunted by these actions. And to be silent in the face of that as a rabbi is inconceivable to me. It's just, I don't understand why every rabbi in the United States wouldn't say, at least on the humanitarian level, that all food should go through and enough food to feed people in Gaza.
I agree with you. It is stunning. And as I said, I'm just can't tell you how pleased I am at your efforts. But how do you explain that? I mean, I agree with you that humanitarian aid, particularly for children at this point, it seems like, you know, a no-brainer. But what's going on?
Well, what's going on is that the international community and Israel and the United States has engaged in a program of demonizing the Hamas government. So that since the election of Hamas, but even preceding it, but especially since the election of Hamas, which of course the United States pushed for there to be an election, but the United States forgot to tell the Palestinian people that it not only wanted an election, but it knew the result it wanted, and it wasn't going to live with a result that was other than that. So lo and behold, Hamas was elected, and at that point we decide, no, that election, we didn't really want it that way, so we're going to now totally cut off ties with Hamas and demonize the Hamas government. So there's a demonization, and there's also a lot of, Michael, there's a lot of propaganda about and misinformation about what's going on in Gaza. I mean, Jews aren't able, and many Americans aren't able to separate out between whatever they feel about the Hamas government and this act of collective punishment. Because I believe there are many people who have different views about this government. But our initiative is not, you know, we're not making any judgment about the Hamas government. You know, we understand the Hamas government, like any other government, has some things they do well and probably some things they are terrible and they commit terrible crimes, like all governments. But the question is, can't one separate out between an opinion about a government and collective punishment of a whole people? This is collective punishment of a whole people. And because there's so much demonization, I don't think most Americans and definitely most Jews have no sympathy. Their hearts are totally closed to the suffering, which under any other circumstance, their hearts would totally be open to.
Now, Rabbi, I want to continue. You had two goals you mentioned. One was the lifting of the Israel's blockade.
No, we have four.
No, there's two that you've mentioned. One was the Israel blockade lifting. The other was the humanitarian and development aid to Gaza. And your third one is the one you've sort of begun to address, is the international community in the U.S. to engage in negotiation with Hamas to end the blockade. And the fourth is to engage Israelis and Palestinians towards a just settlement. So goal number three a little bit. I guess you've started to, really.
Right. Goal number three is simple. It just says you make peace with your enemies. And the boycott of Hamas, when it is the elected government of the Palestinian people in its last free election, which by all observers, there were observers who said it was a free election, unlike many, you know, freer than most countries. And it's a free election, and we're saying we won't talk to them. Why wouldn't we talk to them?
Hamas has
indicated it's so. Israel has created a pretext by which it won't talk to Hamas, in my opinion. The pretext is Hamas doesn't recognize Israel, and Hamas is not willing to renounce violence. So unless it's prepared to do those two things, we won't talk to them.
Now, why do you say that's a pretext?
Why do you say that's even true?
Well, maybe true, but...
not true.
No, I think it's a pretext because does Israel recognize the Palestinian people? Does Israel renounce violence? Why are we asking them to fulfill two conditions Israel's not prepared to fulfill? Nor is it prepared to renounce violence itself. So why is it asking two things of its partner that it's not prepared to do? Why does it need Hamas to do that? All it needs from the enemy or from the party that it needs to negotiate with is the willingness to sit down in negotiations. And Hamas has made it perfectly clear over and over again that it's willing to agree to a ceasefire with Israel, and moreover, it's willing to agree even to a two-state solution that it doesn't really agree with fundamentally, because it believes that the legitimate grievance of the Palestinian people goes back to 48, and it's not prepared. But it says if the Palestinian people agrees to a two-state solution, they'll honor it. As long as the Palestinians agree to it, they'll honor it. So here's a situation where Hamas is saying, we will agree to a ceasefire. We will even agree to a solution that's not quite the ideal solution that we would want, right? And Israel's saying, we won't talk to you. That's why I think it's a pretext. It's a pretext because Israel doesn't want to negotiate. So if it doesn't want to negotiate, it's much easier for it not to negotiate to say the other side. And it's a trick that Israel's done consistently for decades. I mean, it didn't want to negotiate with the PLO either until it did. Yeah. And it's the same thing with Hamas. So the question is, how many Israelis and Palestinians are going to need to die before Israel's going to decide to deal with Hamas? Israel wants the Palestinians to disappear, right?
Yes.
But
you can say that again.
Right?
That's precisely what's going on.
And they haven't, and they're not about to, right? The fact is that Israel's going to need to deal with what happened between Israel and the Palestinians, and it needs to deal with Hamas and all Palestinian parties, and that's why I think it's a pretext.
Rabbi Walt, for the listeners who have just joined us, you're organizing a fast in support of breaking the siege of the Gazan people, many of whom are malnourished children who are stunted. Our audience knows about that, but I think what we're interested in is how we can help you, how we can contact with you, what kind of progress are you making? It's really a turning point, I think, in the solidarity movement here and how it's going.
Right. So Michael Smith, seeing you both, Michael.
Right.
So in the conversation earlier, you pointed out, I think I agree with you, that the Gaza war is a turning point. I know for me in my life, things happened during that war in my relationships with other Americans of all faiths. I particularly know in relationship to a buddy who's not Jewish, who just couldn't talk to me. And eventually I said, what's the problem? And he said, you know, I've always supported Israel, but I can't support this. What's going on there? What are they thinking? I think there's a real opening both in the American community in general to be more critical of the policies of the Israeli government. So this project has generated enormous support. I mean, Rabbi Rosen and I started this as a project we're doing in our spare time, right? We don't have staff. We don't have anything. We just started as a project. We now have over 500 people
who
have signed on to FAST.
It's great.
As of today, there are 560.
And how many rabbis? It says 60 rabbis in the press release.
70 rabbis.
There's 70 now.
70 rabbis at this point. We now have 560 people. They include, I mean, you should go through the list. People should go to our website, which is fastforgaza.net.
Fastforgaza.net.
Fastforgaza.net. It's an easy website to remember. And we encourage people to join the FAST. That's one way people can help. I want to just go back to the support we've got for a moment, and then I'll come to how you can help.
Yeah, I want to hear about the support, and I also want to hear about whether you've gotten any opposition.
Right. So there are 560-some people as of this morning. There were 500 by the first fast, which was last Thursday. Many people fasted. Many people, I want to say, some people who join the fast aren't going to fast from food. Many are. Most are, maybe. But we invite people who, for whom fasting is not a meaningful activity, to devote the day to doing something that is meaningful in relationship to the goals of the fast, and that would be their participation in the fast. That they write a letter to the editor, they give some humanitarian relief, whatever is their way. They organize a public vigil, they talk to friends about it, whatever is they study something about it. We have a bunch of ideas on our website. I came up with 10 ideas for the first fast. But people do it. That there were 560 people. There was an extraordinary call with Sarah Roy, who's an economist at Harvard and a Jewish hero of our time, an unsung Jewish hero. She is the child of Holocaust survivors. She's devoted her academic focus and career to studying Gaza and being in solidarity with the people of Gaza out of her understanding of her Jewish legacy. And we had an astounding presentation by Mona Abu Ramadan, who runs the Milk for Toddlers program of the American Near East Refugee Aid Society. That is the charity that we suggest people make contributions towards, because they provide food for kids in Gaza, and that's the siege is preventing food from reaching people. So we have got enormous support. I think it's so inspiring to me to see a minyan, which is a Jewish term, right, for a community, a minyan that includes rabbis, ministers, and people of conscience of all Americans, and actually includes some people in different countries of the world, including, I believe, there's someone in Tehran and different countries on our list. And we're getting support all the time. Antipathy? Well, we've only got 70 rabbis. I would guess that there are probably 500 rabbis in America easily who agree with what we're saying here. So why aren't they on there? They aren't on there because they feel they're afraid, for the reasons Michael Smith and I talked earlier about losing their jobs, and so out of fear they're not on there. Some rabbis are not on there because they disagree with it. You know, there are a lot of rabbis who disagree. In terms of antipathy, we get, you know, the right wing. I don't know if you both know this. I imagine you do. The Jewish right wing in America is alive and well, and in Israel, and they make themselves heard. So they have made themselves heard to us sometimes.
I'm sure.
Sometimes in more restrained ways, and sometimes in vile, ugly, and violent ways. You know, so we get messages that are vile, ugly, and violent, and we get some messages that are less so, but just are opposing our point of view. And those, the ones that are just opposing our point of view, we in general try to respond to. And we found actually that the most vile and violent ones that we've got so far come from Israel.
Interesting.
From the Israeli right wing. But, you know, it's not going to deter us. Brent and I, Rabbi Rosen and I, decided we would go ahead with this campaign if we only got 10 rabbis. If there were only 10 rabbis in America who were prepared to do this, if they were all one denomination, ours or someone else's, it doesn't matter. We were going to take the step and go forward, because we tried once during the war. It didn't work out. It was inconceivable, not on the table, that we wouldn't go ahead. So we have, and we've got 70 rabbis, and I believe we will get more rabbis on board.
Rabbi Walt, talk to us for just a second about the prophetic tradition in Judaism and where you're coming from spiritually and philosophically.
I don't know how to say it. I mean, justice is the central concern of Judaism. I grew up in South Africa under apartheid, and for me, I was in a very Zionist family, had very deep connections with Israel, and when I read the words of Amos that said, you know, spare me the sounds of your harps and let not the music of your, I know it better in Hebrew than I do in English, but let righteousness well up like water and justice like a mighty stream, that's the essence of Judaism. And for most Jews who aren't religious, that prophetic tradition, along with the historical legacy of the Jewish people as victims, is what defines Judaism for them. They believe that most Jews believe that Judaism is about a response to a legacy of victimization by a profound commitment not to victimize others. Well, whether they're religious or not religious, maybe even especially if they're not religious, they believe that deep in their bones. And they're right. And that's the legacy that we're operating on. The Talmud teaches that Jews are the compassionate ones, the children of the compassionate. Compassionate, the children of the compassionate. Compassion and justice is fundamentally what Judaism's about. And this is a total, total violation of that beautiful, precious legacy of the Jewish people. So I want to say a word, though, about how people can help. People can help by, you know, there's a second fast coming up in August. We hope for that fast to organize public vigils in at least three cities.
That's the third Thursday in August, right?
This idea of a fast in a time of trouble is an ancient tradition. And we have a rabbi who has created a ritual, a stunning ritual that exists in the tradition where the Torah is taken into a public place and ashes are placed on the Torah. Ashes are then placed on the heads of the religious leaders who have abandoned their moral responsibility, and then on the ashes on the heads of all the people assembled. And you declare a public fast in a time of trouble or a time of drought or a time of war. We have taken that ancient tradition and have written a ritual that draws on that for our time, and we hope to do that in at least three cities. At least three cities. We hope many more in the August. And people in any city are invited to have a vigil with the goals of this fast, and that's going to be on August the 20th, and people can sign up to participate in the fast on Fast for Gaza, and our website has resources, has connections to other people, will list the events and so on. We really invite people, and we invite people, all people. We invite Jews, Christians, Muslims, people who are atheists but believe in a sense of morality and have a conscience, people of conscience. I guess I also want to say, for the record, just why is it Jewishly initiated? Because I think that's really important. It's Jewishly initiated because Jews have a special... We thought about this, whether we should just make it a universal fast, right? We should just not be Jewish. We should get together with our colleagues who are Muslim and Christian and do it together. But we chose not to because we felt that, A, the silence of the Jews, of the rabbinical community and of Jews on this issue is especially noticeable because Jews have a deep relationship to Israel and a very special relationship to Israel. I do. Israel's not just any other country to me. And secondly, Jews all have a moral responsibility towards Israel because Israel then claims to be the state of the Jewish people. And as such, we have a special moral responsibility to speak out and to be clear, and then to invite others to join us.
Rabbi Brian Welt, I can tell you on behalf of Michael Ratner and myself, Michael Smith, that we're grateful for your work and your commitment in upholding the ethical and humane traditions of Judaism. We wish you well in this fast. We're supporting you. Your website, again, is
fastforgaza.net.
Every success, Rabbi.
Right. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thank you to you both, really. It means a lot to me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.